Okay. Hi, welcome back to section for CSE 1. I'm Rose, as always. So here's our agenda for today. I'm going to tie up a few loose ends from last section just to clarify a few things, because they're awesome. And then since we saw a movie last week, I figured it'd be cool to have some more history, which hopefully will be interesting for you, and also touch on something that Dan kind of talked about today, about the IP shortage presently. That'll be solved soon, I hope. Cool. So last week we had this slight confusion about like hard disk versus RAM, like they're both memory, but are they different or something like that. So just to clarify, hard disk is persistent. When you turn off your computer and you leave it for like 5 years, it'll still be there, like the data will be there. RAM is volatile, so you need constant electricity. By constant, I mean it needs to be continually refreshed. And by refreshed, I mean like read out and then sort of rewritten back. I'll go more into that in a little bit once we talk about how RAM like stores things and such. But for now, we can just think of it as it needs constant electricity. So once you turn off the power, after a certain amount of time, like was it 5 minutes last time that we saw, the data disappears. So going back to our comparison, for a metaphor, we can use a hard disk can sort of be like a bookshelf where you keep all your books. It's sort of sitting away from your desk. And your data could be like a book collection, you know, stored in your books and stored on the shelf. And then with that metaphor, your RAM would be, I guess, your desk. So in order to, say, read something from a book, i.e. retrieve data, you'd have to walk over to your bookshelf, take a book, stick it on your desk, and, you know, open it up and start reading it. And then, I guess you could, like, you would have to retrieve the book from the shelf first before you could, you know, read it, i.e. compared to, like, RAM. How this relates to RAM is that things in the hard disk need to be transferred to RAM before the computer can like use it or read it or do stuff to it. Yay, metaphor. So as David mentioned, a long while ago, the hard disk is mechanical, you know, with your platters and your read-write heads. So it's slower than, say, RAM, which is electrical, which I'll talk about in a little bit, how that works. And electrical, one of its properties is like being faster than mechanical. So here's just a reminder. That's a weird crinkle in the screen. Here's a reminder of a hard disk. You have your heads there and your set of platters, and the heads glide over the platters, reading data or writing data. And then for RAM, I don't think we've looked at this before, but it sort of looks like this really close up. This is a silicon wafer, and each of these little tiny dots are capacitors and transistors. I'll go into that in the next slide. So don't worry if you're not quite up on your engineering and such. So let's put RAM and hard disk together. How do they work? Like, let's see what happens when your computer, say your CPU, requests some data. I can add data? Well, I'm going to simplify this a bit. It sort of goes into, quote unquote, goes into your hard disk, and then it retrieves the data with, I think you've seen this before, you know, the read-write head using current and magnetism to read or write, depending. And then once it's got that data from the disk, the platter, it sends it to this, well, RAM, which you can sort of think of it as sort of like a grid of capacitors and transistors. And then for those who aren't really up on their hardware, I guess I'm not really either, but a capacitor can store charge, like a certain amount of charge, for a certain amount of time. And unless you keep on sending charge in, it'll slowly dissipate over time. So each of these circles you can think of as like a capacitor, and the transistor just sort of helps guide the electricity in. So if each of these circles are a capacitor, you can sort of think of the charged ones as being 1, and the ones without charge as being like 0. So in that way, we can, you know, store data, as in, does this have charge? Yay! It does, so it's a 1. Or, you know, it doesn't have charge. Alrighty, so going way back to when I talked about memory addresses, if you'll look at the grid here, you can sort of pinpoint each address using like a horizontal line and a vertical line. The computer has, the way of addressing its memory is a bit more complex than this, but you can just imagine it as like, oh, I need column, I don't know, 5 and row 5, and that's going to be like an address there. And then it'll check there and see if, you know, it'll check there, if it's reading, it'll check and see if, you know, oh, the capacitor is, you know, full of charge or without charge. And then if it's, if it has charge, then it'll be a 1, representing a 1. And if it's empty, you know, that's a 0. And yay, addresses. Yes. Questions on RAM or capacitors or transistors, I guess? So anyway, once we have, you know, our data loaded into our RAM, then it can send, quote unquote, that data back to your CPU, which is happy, yay! And of course it goes through like the caches, you know, on its way there, but they pretty much just keep a copy around in case you want to access it again really soon so they can deliver that information quickly, as opposed to going all the way to the hard disk or going all the way to the RAM and, you know, getting that data. Yay, questions on this? Comments, concerns? Okay, so I guess we should move on to another question that we had last time, which I think is pretty important or pretty cool, given the size I'm going to demo, but well, cool for me, I don't know about you guys. Okay, so markup versus programming in terms of languages. As I said before, markup is pretty much all about the formatting or prettifying, I don't know if that's a real word, but making things pretty, quote unquote. Sort of like, you know, bold, italics, underlined, and they're pretty much more or less rendered once. Like once you underline something on your web page, it shows up as like underlined. It doesn't quickly change to blue font or something. It stays there. So it's static, not dynamic. It's not like moving around or something like that. And if we'll look at programming, it's not so much formatting, but it's about execution. Like, what I mean by this is it can do calculations, it can choose outcomes, it can do things like prompt a user for, you know, some sort of input and then act, quote unquote, on that input. So for markup, an example would be, I don't know, a movie poster. You know, it's there, it doesn't really change. If you try to click around or press it physically, it doesn't really like do anything. Or, and then another example would be just like text on a screen that looks pretty, prettifying. And then for programming, an example would be sort of like a game where you can actually click around, you can make decisions or have the computer, you know, prompt you for some input, you know, like asking for user input. So yay, let's look at some examples, which I think are cool, but you might not. So example one for markup is loading this. So as you can see, you know, there's, it looks pretty cool. There's an image here. The font is red. Some of it's, well, I guess caps was my doing. But like you can see, whatever I do to the page, it doesn't really change. I could have had like a hyperlink, but it would have went to a different page. And if we check out the source here, you can sort of see that the formatting that I was talking about. Here it says, like, you know how Wild Pidgey Appeared is red. It's in between the tags color. Tags are things between angle brackets. Color with a U, because that was a design choice on my part, possibly a poor one. But it it corresponds with this declaration up here, which makes the color red. So that's just some formatting. And then you can see that I've, you know, put a picture here. It doesn't change. I've centered the text, or centered the elements inside these center tags. And then here's some more color. So yeah, markup is pretty much you just format the text or you put images in. It's pretty static. Doesn't really like do anything. Let's look at an example of something programmed, something dynamic. So this might look pretty simple. See, no. Is it snowing yet? No. Answer wrong, change it. If I click it, that changed. This changed too. Are you sure? Yes. Really? Yes. Really? Yes. Sheesh, okay. Are you willing to testify to actually having seen snow? Okay, so hopefully it'll do something cool here. And then, yes, I'm gonna say, yes, I have seen snow. And it sort of pulls the same trick for several times. And then I'm just gonna say yes. And then, you know, something cool happens. It has an alert saying, you know, you notified me via text, which should be coming soon. But yeah, and then it sort of points you towards the source code. There you go, there's the text. I got a text from myself saying, it snowed. I guess if you wanna see it, it's right here. So like anyone can get on this webpage. If you had your browsers open, you could totally go here and just send me text through, hey, I see you reaching for your laptop, dot. But you could totally, you could just send me text throughout the section, I guess, and have that little annoying Zelda sound. But cool, so apparently 23 people have pressed yes. So that's another like dynamic sort of thing you can do with programming. And if we go up here and look at the source code, right here, view page source, you can see, okay, sure, there's some formatting since, you know, I made no really big or I centered some stuff. But down here, you can see I have this thing called a switch, which, you know, sort of directs control flow. So depending on how many numbers you clicked the button, it, you know, it displays different messages on the buttons and, like, on screen. So the first click, you'll have, like, are you sure? And then, yes. Really? Yes. And then here you can see some formatting, I for italics and HTML. Really? Yes. And then you can sort of scroll down and see all the sort of paths that the web page like takes depending on how many clicks you have. And if you go down some more, you know, here's some fancy JavaScript stuff. We might go into that in our web development section. But here you sort of see an if, you know, if this condition, if this happens, you know, do this. So that's sort of a dynamic thing depending on what the user did or has done. Okay, so here we can see sort of like some if statements which execute things encased in the curly braces depending on whether the condition was met. Here, like if button, so I'm guessing like if you press the button or if clicks equals 6, you know, if you clicked it 6 times, then, you know, certain things happen. You know, the string changes on screen, stuff like that happens. All of this I've shown you is in JavaScript, which I'm not sure we're going to go over, but I could totally talk about it because it's fun. And I have another cool website all written in JavaScript, but I'm not going to show you that today. So for me, the main difference between a markup language and an actual programming language is, well, programming, you can actually do stuff. You can, like, interact with the user. You can, you know, have them click a button and have something happen because of that. For me, programming is pretty much more dynamic than markup. But there are a few things that markup, I guess, is sort of dynamic. Say you click a link, it changes color, or you hover over it and you get this alt text, like this link goes to blank or something like that. But it's pretty, in my opinion, limited compared to programming languages, which you can do like crazy stuff and make games. And I should just show you my game, but you know, let's not go into that now. Maybe after class or something. Cool, so as I sort of mentioned before, markup, the syntax is more or less, in terms of more or less enclosed in like tags. You specify which chunk of text or data you want to format with like these tags. In HTML, it's with angle brackets that I showed you earlier. With programming, it's a bit more complex. You have these conditionals, you have these other things that direct control. So, let's talk about internets. Yes, that misspelling was on purpose. And in case you can't really see the ASCII art, which I decided to do because I was kind of bored, internets. Let's talk about the internet. But first, we got to talk about the computer because you can't really connect to the internet if you don't really have a machine to, you know, get on the network. So before the time period of what we saw in the movie of, you know, the Pirates of Silicon Valley, we had vacuum tubes. And the transistor was also invented, but it wasn't really used for computing at that time, or computers rather at that time. So with these giant computers, giant machines, you had to use punch cards to program them, which, so how it worked, to my understanding, is the giant machine of a computer had these pins, and then you insert the card, and then since it's a punch card, there are holes. Wait, I think I have a photo of this. So here you go, you can sort of see the holes in certain places on the card, and you would insert this into the machine, and where there are holes, the pins would be sticking up. And where there aren't holes, the pins would be down. And that's how you would program, quote unquote, one of these giant machines. Needless to say, it was tedious. At least I would be very unhappy programming things like this. So an interesting fact that I thought was kind of funny, 1949, Popular Mechanics decided to say, computers in the future may weigh no more than 1.5 tons. So that sort of gives you, an idea of how much they weighed back then. Or, what people thought of them back then. There were giant things that filled rooms, and yeah, it wasn't very, in my opinion, user-friendly. So, let's see what happened after the punch cards. Came magnetic tape. And then, with that, you get IBM's first mass-produced computers. Computers, quote-unquote. These looked like this. Like, all of that. That's just one. And then, you can sort of see how they filled up rooms, and you had to sit in front of this sort of switchboard-looking thing. And it wasn't very, user-friendly. You didn't see graphics. It didn't even have, I don't even see a terminal. So, giant things in giant rooms. And I think IBM mostly, rented them out because they were so hard to, actually build one for your own home, I guess, unless you were super rich or something. But they would rent these out. Or let people use them. And then, anyway, back to our timeline. After this mass-produced, quote-unquote, computers, you get the discovery, or the finding, I guess, of transistors and other components on silicon. So, awesome, they actually could put these things on these pieces of silicon. You don't quite get your, microprocessor, i.e. your CPU, into a bit later. But with that, you get the Altair 8800, which is what we sort of saw in the film. And it looks like that. It's a little box that you can, hold. And when this first came out, when it was sold, it wasn't pre-made for you. It gave you instructions. It gave you the parts. You, the buyer, had to, put it together yourself. So if you messed up, then, oops, I guess you won't get cool blinking lights. But yay, Altair. Or Altair, I guess. And then that's, sort of heading into the territory of Pirates of Silicon Valley. Yay! Which I thought was a pretty cool movie. Hopefully you guys thought the same. Okay, so moving on from that, let's talk about the internet now, as opposed to the computer. In 1969, we have ARPANET, which stands for Advanced Research Projects Agency Network. I don't really expect you guys to know that, but I guess you can memorize it if you want. I don't know. I don't think we'll be, asking you what this means. But it was pretty much the first, the first network of computers. So some people at UCLA, Stanford, UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara. Yay, I'm from Cali, so I'm pretty proud of this list right here. And the University of Utah set up this sort of network that looks sort of like this. Well, this is later on, not when they first, launched the network, of how to communicate with each other. And here you can see that Harvard is right over here. Yay! We joined, the ARPANET later on. But this isn't meant to scare you. It's just used to show you it's a giant network! Yeah! Sort of like the beginning of the internet. Kind of. And then later, it was sort of given to the U.S. Department of Defense for communications, and they were kind of afraid that if war broke out, how would they communicate effectively with, the entire U.S. or something like that. So back then, a lot of computer research was funded, by the government for military uses or things like that. So also in 1969, you had Unix. Yes. It's an operating system, my favorite. Well, I guess I like Windows, I don't know. And then it had a command line interface as opposed to the graphics that we're used to. So where Windows or Mac has like icons and neat little folder icons that you can click in and you get a window, Unix was just something sort of like this. Just had this screen and you had text and you had this command line thing right here that you could just type commands into. Usually you didn't really get cool pictures or cool colors, but I like it. Yay, Unix! Okay, so let's move on towards more familiar things. Email! That was the year email was founded, quote unquote, on ARPANET, so it wasn't quite like Gmail yet. But it was also when the Project Gutenberg happened. Someone thought it, like, sort of the purpose of the internet was to put public information online, so sort of like have a giant database that anyone can access. Wouldn't that be cool? So he started this Project Gutenberg, which you can go and visit today. Ding. So here you can see, you know, all the free ebooks that you can get that people have scanned or typed up or put into this giant database. So yay, that happened in 71. And in 74, the proposal for TCP/IP happened, which I think Dan's going to elaborate in next lecture. So I won't really dive into that too much. Basically, it's just like standards for the internet and how it'll communicate with machines, things like that. 77, first PC modem. This is one of the inventors. I can't quite remember his name. I think it's Dale Hetherington. And his partner is off screen, or off out of the picture. I think the modem is, where's my mouse? This thing, maybe? So yeah, first modem. So modem sort of translates signals into like digital data. So it's sort of the middleman, the communicator between your computer and sort of other, like if you wanted to send something from your computer to another computer, it would go through the modem and then it would go through the signals in the air. It would hit the other modem and then it would translate into like digital information. So yay, modem! Important for communication. So moving on. Since I'm a gamer, I've got to document this, 79. Multi-user dungeon game. So the cool thing about this is a lot of people can get on this game and then they can see each other and interact with each other. Awesome. This is pretty much, sort of like the precursor to World of Warcraft, except it was all in text and you probably couldn't do quite as much stuff, you know, as on World of Warcraft. But this is awesome because previously they had, you know, another sort of textual adventure game, but you didn't really see other players and it was just you playing the game. And then the first emoticon, it was that. It's the little sideways happy face. It was originally proposed as like just this dash in this open parenthesis, 1979, but then someone else was like, that's kind of weird. Let's go with that. So yay! Random tidbits of information. If you guys have questions, please do jump in if you want me to elaborate on certain things or if I'm missing some awesome thing that you know of. Cool, so moving on. So I'm just gonna lump this time period together as internet grows. Lots of people come on, thanks to TCP and IP. Thanks to that standard, a lot of people can connect. And then, yay, big internet, thanks to, standard protocols. 88, you get the internet relay chat, sort of the foundation of all, of the real-time and instant messaging people get today. That happened then. It looks sort of like this. Interestingly, if you read this, someone's asking why this user is on a really old, you know, chat program when no one really uses it anymore. Right here, why do you waste your time on a 6-year-old IRC client when no one uses IRC anymore? Person, I'm not really sure. So I guess this person, you know, went in and decided to check it out for nostalgia or for fun. I did that like 2 months ago. No one was on. I was really sad. So yeah, I think I'll just stick to, Google Chat or something right now. 89, AOL was launched, yeah. They were actually, I think, part of Apple, and then they sort of moved off and then became America Online. And then 1990, ARPANET, you know, kind of goes away, and you have this, I guess, the beginning, quote unquote, second beginning of the internet with your first dial-up internet service provider, ISP, internet service provider. And then you get your first web page. What did this look like? Let's click the link. So it just sort of detailed, just gave you links to information. Let's zoom in a bit. So I sort of told you, okay, what's the World Wide Web, which originally they wanted to call it the mesh, quote unquote, but I'm glad they chose World Wide Web instead. So it's so this first web page, which is documented in like history, sort of gives you links to, oh, what's out there, you know, help if you need help on the browser, some software, and some other links. So cool, very underwhelming in my opinion, but back in the day. And then you have 93, your first web browser, Mosaic. Not sure if you guys know. I didn't really use this. Not a big fan of Mosaic. Looks something sort of like this. Had a graphical interface. Or at least, I guess that's graphical. And then Netscape came along, which I think, in my opinion, is bigger. And then in, I think, 08, they stopped providing support for Netscape. I was kind of sad because this is what I grew up on. I remember the little icon that sort of looks like that, and just kind of, you know, the stars keep coming. So yeah, nostalgia. Sorry if I'm ranting. This is like my childhood here. Okay, so moving on, so I don't further embarrass myself. Let's fast forward to the present. So GeoCities, I'm not sure if you guys know. It was big for me because, well, that's how I made web pages, quote unquote, without programming, because they had a graphical interface. They're down now. 2009, they shut down. It was sad. It was really sad, sad times. And then moving on, 96, first web-based mail service, Hotmail. Apparently that's what it looked like. Now you probably know it as Windows Live or something like that, with that little butterfly. And then for our own amusement, 97, weblog was coined. Yay! Since you guys have all, you know, hopefully blogged on the web through our course blog. Yay, just for fun. 98, Google, and Napster, which is a peer-to-peer program, which Dan sort of talked about. And with Napster, you had LimeWire, Kazaa, uTorrent, BitTorrent. These are all pretty much programs that allowed you to download from your peers, as Dan described, you know, how you get packets of data, and then you sort of let other people download the packets that you already have while you're downloading like other packets from other people who have the packets. So I guess it sort of began the whole, you know, the whole piracy thing and the whole scare back in the day with like, oh no, no one's gonna buy CDs anymore, no one's gonna buy movies anymore. Companies have, I think, adapted to it, you know, with like Netflix and you know, buying your MP3s online and things like that. But back in the day, 98, Napster, that was really big at my school. Not that I partook, other kids did. Wasn't me. 2001, Wikipedia, yes, our encyclopedia. That's almost my go-to source for information about random stuff, like any random stuff. It's right next to like Google. I'd probably Google more. 2003, MySpace. Back in the day, it was super big. Everyone was like, do you have a MySpace? My MySpace looks cooler than your MySpace. Anyway, that, you know, sort of died in 2004 when Facebook, like, took over. So, to my knowledge, these days, MySpace is more of a medium for music artists because they can upload their songs, and then anyone who comes by their page can actually sort of preview or actually listen to the whole song. I'm not sure if they have like a song purchasing thing yet, but I've known a lot of my friends who aspire to be musical artists. They, you know, put their stuff online, and that's sort of like their profile, like their portfolio for music. So to my understanding, that's what MySpace is now. I haven't been on there in a while, so I don't really know. But even more present, 2005, YouTube. And then I think in think, was it in 08? 06, Google buys YouTube. So that's why I think Google's trying to link your YouTube accounts and Google account, for better or for worse. Twitter, 06. Hulu, do you guys know Hulu? The whole like TV show streaming, yeah, let's bring TV to the internet. And the mobile web with, you know, your iPhones, your Blackberries, Android, which, well, I don't have any, but I like Android because it's Google and it's this cute little robot guy. Probably not reasons for why you should like decide against or for any of these. 08, election campaigning online. So I think the presidential election at that time, a lot of the candidates really, really like advertise online. They use like YouTube videos. They had like, well, not MySpace. They had Facebook profiles. They had Twitter feeds, and they would just sort of rally people. They would even have websites where you could donate, you know, give them donations online. So I think that's here to stay. And then we have today, yay! Here we are today with all these cool things that have been mentioned, maybe more that I don't know about, but feel free to shout out if you guys have some favorite website that I haven't covered. Well, I guess like Reddit and Dig and, you know, all the other social media websites I didn't cover, but yay today! And if you're interested for more, you can go to this website, History of the Internet in a Nutshell. They have some interesting tidbits, like how the first webcam was made because people didn't want to like go downstairs to get coffee and just find the coffee pot empty, so they just set up like a cam there so they could just watch it and be like, oh, I want coffee. Is there a coffee there? Oh, yeah, there is. I'm going to go get coffee. So that was pretty cool. I mean, I would have done something like that since I drink coffee just to stay awake. But yay! Cool. So moving on, branching out from the internet and its awesome websites. We've sort of got this problem with all these sites and all these machines connecting with all the devices that can connect to the internet. Each of those machines needs an IP address, right? So servers and, you know, your machine can communicate with each other. So we have this problem. Dan, you know, touched on it. It's not quite this problem here. Last page of internet, what? So let me zoom in here. It says, attention, you have reached the very last page of the internet. We hope you have enjoyed your browsing. Now turn off your computer and go outside. And then if you'll notice the URL, it's www.www.com.com, which I guess is supposed to suggest that all the URLs have been exhausted. But I mean, this web page has been up for a while. I think even before maybe YouTube. I don't remember when I first saw it, but anyway, that's not this problem. That's not the problem of being low in IP addresses, because as Dan sort of hinted at, you can actually map different URLs to like the same IP. So that's, you know, that's not quite the problem. So let's first talk about an IP address. What is it? It's an address given to a machine that wants to connect to the internet. So Dan showed you a page that you can sort of see your IP. Here's another one, which gives you more direct information about what they know about you. Here's my IP currently. They know my internet service provider is Harvard. They know my connection is broadband. I'm not using a proxy. I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the United States. And they sort of think I'm here. Let's see. Well, they know I'm in Cambridge, so that's kind of scary, right? They know a lot about me. And if you go here, what is myipaddress.com, you can probably see if it knows about you too. Knows, quote unquote. I suspect they're just looking at, you know, the IP address, the subnet mask that Dan was talking about to sort of figure out where you are. But yep, that's my IP address. And then, so Dan kind of already talked about this. So currently we have 4.3 billion IP addresses available. About 7 billion people in the world, problematic possibly, especially, well, not everyone has, you know, a machine that connects to the internet, but some of us have several machines that connect to the internet and possibly need, you know, IP addresses. And then here's a very fuzzy picture of sort of the, if you remember, Dan showed you in class the XKCD you know, here's the IP land address. Here's what it looks like since 2 weeks ago, I think, when they gave out the last chunk of, you know, chunk of IP addresses. Anyway, the chunks have been given out. That doesn't mean that they've all been used up. It just means that there aren't any more, you know, IP chunks to allocate to, say, a new company who wants, you know, a Class A or something like that. So, you know, that's problematic, right? OMG, we can't. All our IP addresses have been given out. What? So, to solve this, the world decided, you know what? We're going to have a new IP standard, IP version 6, which, you know, Dan mentioned and probably will go into more. This isn't just adding more numbers. It's more of a new system, sort of like, and then they'll need pretty much everyone to transition, or they'll have, like, viewing problems, sort of like, in my opinion, like the switch to digital TV. Funny story. At college, I don't really have a TV, so I don't really watch things, and I don't really know, like, the whole switch thing. I go home, I turn on the TV, every channel is static. I'm like, Mom, Dad, the TV's not working, what? They're like, oh yeah, we, you know, that switch to digital TV, that, yeah, we didn't really do that. It's like, what? But I need TV. So I had to, you know, go and get them the little, like, box thing and had set it up. Because my parents watch channels from another country, you know, Vietnam, that's where they're from. And it's in their native language, so they know it better. So they didn't really care too much about this digital TV conversion in the US. So I had to go home and do that for them. But yeah, IP version 6, when that happens, you guys should, like, transition. Otherwise, you might not be able to view websites, you know, correctly. And then sort of to help this, June 8th, is going to be World IPv6 Day. So they're pretty much going to have a trial run of this, you know, IPv6 standard. They've gotten, like, Yahoo, Facebook, and I think Google to help them out, since people go to their websites, you know, like billions or millions of people go to those websites a day. So those giant websites will be helping out with this test run on June 8th. So you should totally go to Google on June 8th, or Yahoo, or Facebook, which you might already have planned to do without me telling you. Yay! So yeah, don't worry. We're gonna solve this problem. The internet is okay. It's okay. It'll be fine. So, that's all I have for today. Do you guys have any questions, topic suggestions? Yay, nay? Awkward staring? Okay, we like that, awkward staring. All right, awesome. Well, if you don't have anything, well, I guess we can't really do this today, but, oops, I forgot. Anyway, in case you think of something after you've left section, you can totally email me, and then, or you can use the anonymous form, which is listed up there, the shortened URL is up there, and you can send me a message, say, I really want to cover blank, you know, whatever blank may it be video games, or internet, or MySpace, I don't know, how to make a web page, which I'm sure we'll go over, so I guess we can give you a preview or something like that. But if you've nothing else to do, here's something interesting that at least I think is interesting. It's a bit too late for today, but Jeopardy! They're taking a computer and it's gonna compete against two of the best human players on Jeopardy. Tonight, 7:30, which is kinda past, I think. Tomorrow night, which you can watch, or I guess you can watch the rerun whenever they decide to put that up, and the day after, these 3 days, this computer named Watson is going to compete, and then we will see who wins. And I think the money's going to be donated to charity, so there's no, like, what's a computer going to do with money? So they should be cool, guys. I'm excited. Hopefully you are too. Maybe you aren't, but so who do you think's going to win? Oh, we can start taking bets, right? No, kidding. No gambling here. Okay. Yay, nay, other comments?
Well, the computer already won it already beat the two guys many times before this.
Wait, it hasn't, what's this about?
Oh, they did test runs against.
Oh, okay. Already. You did? Oh, okay. That's awesome. So one of our students appeared to have blogged on this. I need to go read it now.
Don't.
You're going to TiVo it? Or you TiVo'd it? I see.
Or did TiVo it.
Okay. Awesome. So we are interested in this sort of thing. But yep, this is what I'm going to try to watch for the next 2 days. Yay! So I guess we're going to end a bit early. If you don't have any other questions, comments, I guess you can tell me anonymously. Yay, thanks for coming.